Jesus, the reliability of the Gospels and the Christian worldview. He has well over 20 years of experience as a minister on campuses throughout the world, and most recently he served as a technical consultant and assistant writer for the books God's Not Dead, Man, Myth, Messiah, as well as the first book, God's Not Dead, which of course fueled the movies God's Not Dead that's come out in the last couple of years. His expertise is speaking in forums where he addresses most challenging questions faced by Christians, skeptics, and other believers in other faiths. So he's going to come and he's going to really share some knowledge from not only the Christian worldview, but from his expertise as a scientist. A lot of people think that Christianity and science are in conflict, but in fact, they are not. It's funny, one of the first things that God ever told Adam to do was what we call taxonomy, giving names to things. So inherently, God and science could not be in conflict. He's going to talk about that as well as get on to talking about the existence of God. So thank you guys so much. We're going to break down into groups after he gets done. We'll have some small groups, and then we're going to come back together for questions. All right, would you guys please welcome Dr. Brian Miller.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here. This is the first time I've been to the Clarksville Church, so it's a great time to be here. I've heard wonderful things about you and about your staff too. And I've had some of your leaders in my class at the ENLI, which was really enjoyable. So it's a pleasure to be here. Now, who's been able to download the app? A couple people? What's going to happen is it costs a dollar, so if that breaks you, I have extra dollars I can give out to you. I'm assuming you can afford that. But what this app does is it contains all the information I'm going to talk about tonight. Plus, I'll be talking about, over the next several weeks, I'll be adding more and more information. So this app is going to be your local apologetics resource center, so everything I talk about tonight, you can reproduce to your friend next door. In fact, you don't even have to understand it. You can just flip the right button and you can hand over the phone. So it just makes life a lot easier. That way, I don't have to have everyone calling me with questions they have about science or whatever. But what we're going to talk about today is essentially the evidence for God. And if you're not familiar with the term apologetics means defending the Christian faith. And it comes from 1 Peter 3, where Peter talks about how you should always be prepared to give the reason for the faith that you have. And the word reason in Greek is apologia, which is where we get the word apologetics. So apologetics is not saying you're sorry for being a Christian. Apologetics is defending why you believe it to be true. And this has been a really significant issue because I was raised in the church, but when I went to MIT, what happened was I took a class on the Bible taught by a fellow that was probably an atheist or agnostic. And he taught the Bible was just unhistorical. It was a lot of fables. And I became pretty convinced for a while that Christianity was just a psychological crutch. I also read an atheist named Richard Dawkins who argued that the appearance of design in the world is an illusion, that everything is simply the product of the blind forces of nature. At that point, I became pretty convinced that maybe God didn't exist. So I remember going to my room and saying, God, I don't know if you exist, but if you do exist, you have to prove it to me because I'm a scientist. I just can't follow this blindly. I mean, lots of people give nice testimonies of how God touched their life and had warm, fuzzy feelings in their heart, but that did nothing for me. I want to know the facts and the evidence. So I said, though, God, if you would show me the evidence and showed me what was true, then I would follow it with all my heart. And what happened over the next several years, as I studied history and philosophy and comparative religions and archaeology and a lot of disciplines, and what I came to realize is that people don't reject the Christian faith because of the evidence, but in spite of it. That the evidence for God's existence is truly dramatic, and the evidence for the resurrection is as strong as virtually any fact of ancient history. So we'll be sharing with you tonight some of that evidence. Now, the God's Not Dead app is basically your apologetic center, and this is the front page, and it has some information about the books we've done and the movies. These are common questions and answers. So that button gives you a quick answer to the most common questions people have of the Christian faith. It's very, very quick. Now, the examine the evidence goes into more detail. So when you look at the examine the evidence, if you hit that button, you'd get this, where it's a nice intro video with Rice Brooks. Five featured videos is five of some of the best apologetics videos that we had permission to present on the app. That's just kind of a neat thing to look at for fun. The in-depth topics is what we'll talk about tonight. This will go into depth about the various topics that you might want to discuss. And the last one is the experts, which give you interviews with Rice and the major experts on apologetics, with links to their websites. So when you go to the in-depth topics, you get this. This is like the major topics we're talking about. So the first ones we have is just Evidence for God, which is a nice video that you may have seen before. The universe began, the universe was designed, and if you scroll down, you'll see science and Christianity, universe is designed for life, and then how it's designed for humans. And there's also in that section one on the resurrection. So that's just kind of in-depth topics. Now when you click those buttons, what you get is a nice video, and then just a nice written description of how to address a topic, and then links at the bottom to other resources which will be helpful for you. So everything I talk about tonight will literally be at your fingertips. So, and this just came out a few days ago, so you're the first people to see it. Isn't that exciting? I'm excited. So what we'll do is I'm gonna go through some of the evidence, I'll talk about where it is on the app, and then when you get into your small groups, you can help share the evidence with each other using the app. So let's begin with the issue of faith and science. Because many people have the perspective that faith and science are in conflict. Perhaps you may have heard the story about Galileo, how he was persecuted by the Catholic Church, or the Scopes monkey trial. But a lot of these stories are actually not historical. When you look at the relationship between faith and science through history, they weren't adversaries, they were closely aligned. In fact, Albert Einstein had this great quote, where he talked about how the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible. And that's significant, because the reason science developed in Europe, the reason you have people like Newton and Galileo and Kepler and Boyle and all these great people, is because of their faith. Because to do science, you have to believe that there's order in the universe. And you also have to believe that your brains have the ability to understand that order. Now that makes sense if there's a God who's a creator that gave laws that govern the universe. In the same way God gave moral laws, he also gave physical laws of why the universe works. And because we're created in God's image, we have the ability to understand that order. In fact, even the commission, remember in Genesis where it says, go and steward creation, go and take dominion of the earth? That essentially is a commission to do science, to understand the world around you. So the reason that science was birthed in Western Europe is because Christianity gave the essential assumptions that science rests upon. If you don't believe in the Christian God, you really don't have a reason to do science. I mean, sure, you can explore the world like the Greeks and so forth, but if you think your brain just evolved, why would you believe your brain evolved to understand quantum mechanics or general relativity, or at least my brain? Why would you expect your brains to evolve to understand the way the universe functions? That makes no sense. That doesn't help you eat or flee predators. So atheists can do science, but they have to borrow assumptions from Christians. So that I found to be very encouraging. But even beyond the foundations of science, when you study modern science, what happens is the more we learn about the universe, the more it points to God. Because before the time of Einstein and the modern scientists, people thought the universe was eternal. It was always here, like the Greeks. And if the universe was always eternal, anything could happen, right? But what Einstein recognized with general relativity and future scientists such as Hubble, what they realized is that the universe had a beginning. Now, if the universe had a beginning where all of time and space began, that means it had a beginner, someone that started it, who is outside of time and space and infinitely powerful, who started everything in a burst of energy. Now, what does that sound like? Gosh, that rings a bell. It sort of sounds like Genesis 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. God said, let there be light. So what you see is that modern cosmology pointed back to Genesis. Now, even beyond that, what we find is something truly extraordinary, because if you imagined a universe, and imagine you had any set of laws, any set of random laws to create a universe, any particular law for gravity or electromagnetism, the odds of those laws producing a life-supporting universe is essentially zero. The only reason our universe supports life is because the laws of physics were very carefully designed to make that happen. Because imagine you have something like a mixer board, and this mixer board is your universe starter kit. So these knobs and dials control the laws of physics. You turn one dial up, gravity gets stronger. Turn it down, gravity gets weaker. Turn another knob, and then the force that holds the proton to the electron gets stronger. Turn it down, it gets weaker. And you have dozens of these knobs. These knobs have to be carefully set, or else the universe wouldn't do anything interesting. It would just be a lot of particles floating through space, or a lot of black holes. That's it. That's what virtually every laws of physics would make happen. To have life, you have to have planets. To have life, you have to have chemistry. But that requires what's called fine-tuning of the laws. What fine-tuning means, you've got to set those dials just right. Anyone ever work at a concert before? What happens if one of those knobs is way off? It's like a roo! This is terrible feedback. It's the same thing with our universe. So let's say the mass of the neutron was slightly larger, like a few percent larger or a few percent lighter. You wouldn't have the atoms necessary for life. You either have like all hydrogen or heavy elements. You wouldn't have carbon or nitrogen or anything useful like that. So that'd be like a dial from 1 to 100. It has to be like a 97. Other knobs are far more carefully set. Gravity, for instance. Imagine you have a ruler which is the size of our universe. And imagine that the gravity is set at a certain point. If you go 1 inch greater or 1 inch less in comparison, you wouldn't have planets. No planets, no life. So that's an incredible level of fine-tuning that you have to set that dial with unbelievable precision, or else life would not exist. And it's not just true with the laws of physics. You also see it with our Earth, our sun, our moon, our solar system have countless details that have to be right or life would not exist. Let me use an analogy. Let's imagine you're hiking in the park and you come across this cabin. And you go into the cabin and you notice the cabin has your favorite food in the refrigerator. It has your favorite clothes in the closet that perfectly fit you. Then you notice it has pictures of all your relatives and friends on the wall. Then you notice a cell phone with your best friend's numbers programmed into it. How many of you would say to yourself, wow, what an amazing coincidence? No? You would know that if so many things were set up with you in mind, somebody knew you were coming and set it up deliberately. The exact same thing is true with our planet, with our sun, with our moon, with our galaxy, with the laws of physics, with our entire universe. Now, just as a quick summary, here's a video which is on your app, which I will show you. I assume you can all lip read, right? See what happens when it's not finely tuned?
People had accepted the cultural narrative that God is obsolete, that as science progresses, there's less need for a God to explain the universe.
There we go. Okay, I'll try that again.
In 1966, Time magazine ran a cover story asking, "Is God dead?" The cover reflected the fact that many people had accepted.
The music is probably just on one of the apps there. Okay, there we go. All right, great. We'll try again. Third time's always a charm.
In 1966, Time magazine ran a cover story asking, "Is God dead?" The cover reflected the fact that many people had accepted the cultural narrative that God is obsolete, that as science progresses, there's less need for a God to explain the universe. It turns out, though, that the rumors of God's death were premature. In fact, perhaps the best arguments for his existence come from, of all places, science itself. Here's the story. The same year Time featured its now famous headline, the astronomer Carl Sagan announced that there were two necessary criteria for a planet to support life: the right kind of star and a planet the right distance from that star. Given the roughly octillion planets in the universe, that's one followed by 24 zeros, there should have been about septillion planets, that's one followed by 21 zeros, capable of supporting life. With such spectacular odds, scientists were optimistic that the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, known by its initials SETI, an ambitious project launched in the 1960s, was sure to turn up something soon. With a vast radio telescopic network, scientists listened for signals that resembled coded intelligence. But as the years passed, the silence from the universe was deafening. As of 2014, researchers have discovered precisely bupkis, nada, zilch, which is to say zero, followed by an infinite number of zeros. What happened? As our knowledge of the universe increased, it became clear that there were, in fact, far more factors necessary for life, let alone intelligent life, than Sagan supposed. His two parameters grew to 10, then 20, and then 50, which meant that the number of potentially life-supporting planets decreased accordingly. The number dropped to a few thousand planets and kept on plummeting. Even SETI proponents acknowledged the problem. Peter Schenkel wrote in a 2006 piece for Skeptical Inquirer, a magazine that strongly affirms atheism, "In light of new findings and insights, we should quietly admit that the early estimates may no longer be tenable." Today, there are more than 200 known parameters necessary for a planet to support life, every single one of which must be perfectly met or the whole thing falls apart. For example, without a massive gravity-rich planet like Jupiter nearby to draw away asteroids, Earth would be more like an interstellar dartboard than the verdant orb that it is. Simply put, the odds against life in the universe are astonishing. Yet, here we are, not only existing, but talking about existing. What can account for it? Can every one of those many parameters have been perfectly met by accident? At what point is it fair to admit that it is science itself that suggests that we cannot be the result of random forces? Doesn't assuming that an intelligence created these perfect conditions in fact require far less faith than believing that a life-sustaining Earth just happened to beat the inconceivable odds? But wait, there's more. The fine-tuning necessary for life to exist on a planet is nothing compared with the fine-tuning required for the universe to exist at all. For example, astrophysicists now know that the values of the four fundamental forces, gravity, the electromagnetic force, and the strong and weak nuclear forces, were determined less than 1/1,000,000th of a second after the Big Bang. Alter any one of these four values ever so slightly, and the universe as we know it could not exist. For instance, if the ratio between the strong nuclear force and the electromagnetic force had been off by the tiniest fraction of the tiniest inconceivable fraction, then no stars could have formed at all. Multiply that single parameter by all the other necessary conditions, and the odds against the universe existing are so heart-stoppingly astronomical that the notion that it all just happened defies common sense. It would be like tossing a coin and having it come up heads 10 quintillion times in a row. I don't think so. Fred Hoyle, the astronomer who coined the term Big Bang, said that his atheism was greatly shaken by these developments. One of the world's most renowned theoretical physicists, Paul Davies, has said that the appearance of design is overwhelming. Even the late Christopher Hitchens, one of atheism's most aggressive proponents, conceded that without question, the fine-tuning argument was the most powerful argument of the other side. Oxford University professor of mathematics, Dr. John Lennox, has said, "The more we get to know about our universe, the more the hypothesis that there is a creator gains in credibility as the best explanation of why we are here." The greatest miracle of all time is the universe. It is the miracle of all miracles, one that inescapably points to something or someone beyond itself. I'm Eric Metaxas for Prager University.
That's just a nice overview of the evidence from physics and astronomy and cosmology. Now, there is one area of science that people feel is often in conflict with faith, and that's biology. So what happens, though, is the more biologists have been looking at DNA, looking at the fossil record, looking at the structure of life, the more they're realizing that there's evidence of design which is just as strong, if not stronger, than you see from cosmology and in the study of the planets. In particular, people say that evolution can explain everything that we see, all of life. But the problem is, evolution only explains what happens after you have life, quoting from the movie. It doesn't explain where life came from. So the question is, could the first life, could the first cell have come about by chance? And the answer to that is no. And one reason for that is that nature has two driving tendencies. One is to go from high energy to low energy. Water runs downhill, water doesn't run uphill. The second tendency is to go from order to disorder. It's easier to keep your room neat, or messy, than to keep it neat. You don't try to keep it messy all the time, but you come back and it's always orderly. That doesn't happen. It goes the other way. However, the first cell has very high order and very high energy. So it's physically impossible for the basic building blocks of life, which are very disordered and very low energy, to form a cell spontaneously in the same way water doesn't run uphill, water runs downhill. But there's an equally and even more striking issue. If you look at the simplest possible cell that first existed, it had to contain DNA, because without DNA, it couldn't reproduce and would simply have broken and fallen back to pieces. So the simplest possible cell had to have a few thousand letters of DNA. Now, if you remember DNA from your school days, DNA has an alphabet of three letters, which are the nucleotides, the A, C, T, and G. Do y'all remember that? And that functions a lot like digital code. Like if you program a computer, do you ever see like those ones and zeros? And how some combination of ones and zeros gives you an A and then a C, and they'll eventually give you letters and instructions which run your program. So what happens is for DNA to function, these letters have to be in a very, very specific sequence. In the same way, the letters of the alphabet have to be in a very specific sequence to give you a paragraph, to give you a story. So that essentially is information. And information is only the product of a mind. Information has no mass, no chemical properties, no electrical properties. It's purely conceptual. So there's no physical process that's going to put the orders of the letters in DNA in the right sequence to run a cell anymore. Here's another analogy. Any of you ever eat alphabet soup? Well, remember you stir the soup up and you kind of wait to see like a word form like cat or something? Now, if you stirred up your alphabet soup and then went to the bathroom and came back and you saw, "Get a lot of rest, dear. I hope you feel better." Now, how do you think you could explain that by the chemistry of the pasta or the physics of the boiling water? No, that ordered sequence can only be explained by the product of a mind. In the same way, the ordered sequence of letters in DNA shows intelligence. And as one more example, any of you get like a pocket text, like a random series of letters? Well, you would know if it was like A, X, explanation point. That was probably an accident. Someone sat on their phone. But what if you got the letter, you got the letters that said, "Don't tell anyone, but I cheated on the test." How do you think that would be a pocket text? Well, if you look at the simplest possible cell, it had, again, thousands of letters in the right order, which could not possibly happen by chance or by any physical law. Therefore, the information in DNA points to a creator. But it's not just the origin of life, because if you remember Darwin's evolution, the whole idea of evolution is that you have a cell that forms, and then that cell becomes more complex and eventually breaks into the major divisions of nature. You've got animals, plants, fungi, bacteria, and then those major divisions break into smaller divisions, into, let's say, the different phyla, things like your corals, things like your sea urchins, things like your jellyfish. Those are phyla. That's the biggest division in nature. And the whole idea of evolution is that over time, you should see gradual change, and eventually that leads to bigger changes. That's the whole idea of Darwinian evolution. But the fossil record is very different. You have what's called the Cambrian explosion. That's where you have cells and a few other things that go way, way back. And then at one point in history, like 550 million years ago, you see the first representatives of the major body plans for animals that we know today. So the first time you see anything like a sea urchin, anything like a vertebrate, anything like a, it all appears suddenly with no series of ancestors going back to the trunk of the tree, then once a species appears, it never changes. That's the picture of the Cambrian explosion. It looks nothing like a blind process. It looks exactly like the book of Genesis, day one, day two, day three, as long as you allow some flexibility. So again, if you look at the fossil record, it looks like creation. And again, in the same way you needed information for the first cell, to radically rearrange these body plans requires enormous amounts of new information to reprogram your cells. More design. Okay, so that's a bit of science. Now, the last topic we're going to talk about is the issue of who's the creator, because it's fine for science to point to a god, but who is that god? Is it the god of Christianity, the god of Islam? Is it an impersonal god? Is it some philosophical god, the god of the Greeks, the Demiurge? Well, what we know, though, is that the universe was created by an omnipotent, all-powerful intelligence. So that god is all-powerful outside of time and space. We also know that if that god programmed our DNA, that god is very much involved in the world. He's not distant. But the question then is, why is the world such a mess? If God is all-powerful and deeply involved and cares about us, why is the world a mess? Well, that only is explainable with the Christian story, because the Christian story talks about how God created the world as good, but people rebelled against God and said, God, we don't need you. We'll do it our way. And God said, okay. So the evil and suffering of the world is the product of God giving people the choice to turn away from him and using that choice badly. So you might ask, why did God give us a choice in the first place? Well, let me ask you this. Would you rather marry someone that chose to marry you or someone that was socially conditioned through shock treatment to marry you? Well, most likely you would want someone marrying you because of a choice. In the same way, for God to have real relationship with us, we had to have the choice to either follow him or turn away, and people turned away, which is why there's evil and suffering. Well, of course, that points to the issue of Jesus Christ, because God didn't abandon humanity, but God stepped into the world to fix it, that he took the power of evil upon himself and defeated it. So if we have faith in him, he'll forgive our sins, defeat the evil in our heart, and give us the promise of eternal life. But is that true? Did that really happen? I mean, how do we know it's not just made up? Well, that gets to the issue of the resurrection, because a lot of people make up a lot of things. Like, there's stories around, you've heard of urban legends, lots of stories that everyone thinks are true, but it's really not true. However, there's also stories that are true that people deny. Like, here's one for you. How many people believe that the United States was the first people to walk on the moon? Most people, right? Yeah. Are you aware that some people think it's actually staged? That those pictures of Neil Armstrong were actually taken in a movie set? So, again, there's a lot of things that are true that some people deny. So let me ask you a question. How do you know we actually walked on the moon? What sort of evidence could you look for to determine that? Yes? Moon rocks. Great. Oh, did you touch one? Oh, that's awesome. So we have physical evidence. That's really, really awesome. And you can actually do chemical tests on it, and it's very different from most rocks on Earth. What else? Stories, eyewitness testimonies. Now, let me ask you, here's a very subtle question. Let's imagine you interviewed the astronauts that claimed to walk on the moon. Now imagine that their testimonies were exactly the same verbatim, word for word. Would that be suspicious or would that be encouraging? No, we're talking worse, word for word. Suspicious, right? Because, yeah, word for word, it would be very suspicious. So if you're looking at real eyewitness testimony, you'd expect it to agree in the overarching details, right? But you'd expect different details because of different perspectives and so forth. Did Neil Armstrong step with his left foot, his right foot? Well, we don't quite remember. You know, you see what I'm saying? So you expect the testimony to be very, very similar, but also to have little differences. That's what true testimony is. Also, you might look at other news reports. Is there other confirming documentation that support the basic stories that the people tell? So there's ways we can test if things are historically true or if they're not true. What happens when we apply these methods to the New Testament? To the story, the writings of, let's say, Josephus or Roman historians, and ask, what do historians know about the first century and about Jesus? And there's a guy named Gary Habermas that did this. Like, he was doubting his faith, and he said, if I can prove the resurrection, I can save my faith. So he studied over 2,000 scholars in English, in German, in French. So he looked at all the scholars he could find that talked about the Jesus. He found that there were certain facts of history that they virtually all agreed upon. Because the best historical criteria, if you apply them to these facts, they become indisputable. So what are the facts that they agree on? And this doesn't even matter if you believe in the Bible. You could think the Bible is completely false, but you still would have to believe these facts because they're bedrocks of history. Well, one fact is that Jesus actually died. Virtually, I mean, it's not just the New Testament, all the gospel writers, but also people like Tacitus, who was a Roman historian, people like Josephus. Lots of people talked about that Jesus died. So that's a fact of history. But also, another interesting fact is that his tomb was empty. Now, you will find more scholars that deny this, but not because of the evidence, but because of the implications. But if you apply the best methods of history, like multiple independent sources, is a great way to test history, right? All of the gospel writers talk about the empty tomb. Now, who actually were the first witnesses of the empty tomb? Women. Now, that may not be a big idea to us, but in the first century, the testimony of women was not considered valid in a court of law. So if you were just making up these stories, would you say that women were the first eyewitnesses? No one would make that up. So for that reason, virtually the majority of scholars and those who are really intellectually honest virtually all agree that the tomb was empty. That's a fact of history. Now, another fact of history is that the disciples believed that they encountered Jesus after he rose from the dead. Now, a skeptic wouldn't say they really did, right? But a skeptic would say the historical evidence is overwhelming that the disciples believed that they encountered Jesus after he rose from the dead. Because what do all the Bible stories talk about? They talk about how the disciples ran for dear life, right? Now here's what a lot of people think. A lot of people think the Bible was made up by the early church to consolidate their power. Have you ever heard that? Yeah. To prop up their leaders, to make them look more grandiose. But if you're going to make up a story, are you going to make the men look like a bunch of sniveling cowards running for dear life and it's the women that went to the tomb? No, that's not what you're going to do. If you're going to make it up, you're going to say the men heroically went to the tomb, knocked out the guards, and met Jesus, who congratulated us on our faith and bravery. No. And then we went to comfort the women. That's how I'd make it up. But the fact that all these stories talk about how the disciples ran for dear life, they denied Jesus. Then what happened is a few days later, they were proclaiming at the risk of their life that Jesus rose from the dead. Because Jesus was killed as a revolutionary. And what do the Romans look for after the head of the revolutionaries is killed? All the followers. So the disciples were risking their life by proclaiming this. In fact, many of them died for their faith. Now, do you know anyone in all of history who's died for a lie, that they knew was a lie? Now, people will die for a lie all the time. But who dies for what they know is a lie? Anyone? No one. So you have to, if you don't believe in the resurrection, you have to believe in this vast conspiracy where they all just made this up at the risk of their life to gain nothing. Now, of course, another fact of history is it's not just the disciples, but Paul himself. Now, who was Paul? Paul was a persecutor of the church who went from being a persecutor to a proclaimer of the resurrection after he believed he encountered Jesus on the road to Damascus. So even skeptics believe Paul's telling the truth. Because what would motivate him to go from a persecutor to a leader unless he believed to have an encounter with Jesus? Also, James, the brother of Jesus. Now, how many of you have siblings, like brothers or sisters? Yeah. How many of you ever mistook your sibling for the savior of the world? Not too often, right? So James, who is a skeptic, you remember Mark talks about how his family came to capture Jesus? So Mark, who is a skeptic, I'm sorry, James, who is a skeptic, went from being a skeptic to a leader in the church after he believed he encountered Jesus rise from the dead. So if you look at these facts, you look at the fact that Jesus died, he was crucified, the women followers discovered the tomb was empty, disciples believed they encountered Jesus, Paul believed he encountered Jesus, and that James went from a skeptic to a leader of the church. How do you explain those facts? Well, one explanation, the only one that people really go to these days, is that it was all a hallucination. All the disciples, Paul, James, it was just, no, but that's kind of like, imagine this my talk is being videotaped, and you review the videotape a week from now, and I'm actually not here, I'm just a hallucination. What's the likelihood of that? But that's the likelihood that all of his followers just hallucinated that he rose from the dead. So no competent psychologist goes with that. So the only real explanation that makes any sense is that Jesus actually rose from the dead. That's not a statement of faith. That is a statement of historical fact. Now, if Jesus actually rose from the dead, what does that mean? That means that God was really behind him, that his words were true. He really was the savior of the world. And if that's the case, you can be pretty confident that God would ensure that the testimony about him would have been faithfully preserved and passed on from generation to generation. And there's also other facts that why we trust the Bible too, which I could get into in the question and answer. So those are some basic facts of history. I just want to end with this one video to summarize the points I just made.
Dude.
Hey, what's up?
What you reading?
The Bible.
You're reading the Bible?
Yeah.
Dude, why are you reading the Bible? For class?
No, I just...
Okay, so you're just reading the Bible. You're just sitting here in a coffee shop in the 21st century using state-of-the-art technology to read ancient myths for no reason whatsoever.
Well...
Tell me something. Are you one of those super religious people who thinks Jesus actually rose from the dead?
Well, I do believe that.
Do you also believe in the Easter Bunny? Santa Claus? Unicorns? Bigfoot? Ever been abducted by aliens? And do you buy into all those other ancient myths about dying and rising gods invented by...